Discover Ag podcast is brought to you by Case IH. Case IH has solutions for every challenge, equipment for every farm. Case IH is built by farmers.
You're listening to a 58 Ember production.
Good morning, Discovering Discos. This week, we discover the pop star who is rocking California's organic wine scene, how the most popular snack in the U.S. is not what you'd expect it to be, and how cows could give big pharma a run for its money.
Welcome to Discover Ag, where food meets pop culture. We're your hosts, Natalie Antara, millennial cattle rancher and dairy farmer, and every Thursday we go beyond the headlines to discover what's new in the world of food. And today I'm coming to you under five layers of blankets because I still have no heater. And I know last week I said it's really not that bad. It's been like 70 degrees outside. That was before the spring snow came. And now my house is 50 degrees and I'm freezing to death.
I know you are being a little bit dramatic right now. You're giving drama is what you're giving.
I'm sorry. I'm so tired of being cold in my house. Like at some point you just get worn down. You know, you're just like, I don't know. I just can't do it anymore.
Yeah, I think as a Nebraska resident and Montana native, I am very familiar with how you can get worn down by the weather, Tara.
I will say it did snow yesterday, but there's no actual snow like left on the ground. I don't know if it ever even actually stayed on the ground. And so when I saw your stories this morning and then you just said the kids have been home from school for 2 days, I was like, I feel like I should start this intro in a different direction. But I just decided to go for it and just, you know, be a southern state and just not be able to handle cold weather.
No, I mean, this is very typical for us, as sad it is we always get a spring winter storm. So by this point in my life, 36 years later, I'm used to it. I know it's coming. It's funny, one of the worst storms we had within the last couple of years, we lost power for like 3 or 4 days, and it was an April snowstorm. I mean, they just, Mother Nature rears her head for some reason, like right before spring.
I completely agree. We don't get it as bad as you, but my mom always says, do not plant a single flower outside before Mother's Day. And Mother's Day is like well into May, but we will always have a late April freeze. Like it never, ever fails. It's like Easter this year is really early, but I feel like there's been so many times we have a freeze on Easter when Easter is like in April. Like it's just wild. I don't know. Sometimes whenever we get snow in April, I'm like, go home, Mother Nature. You're drunk.
I know. It is funny when kids are like hunting for Easter eggs in snow. You're like, go, let you know.
I love that cute little Easter dress I bought that's all petals and flowers and rainbows, but it's actually, you have like four layers on underneath.
Oh, how was your guys' weekend? Was it good?
Yeah, it was good. I'm like, can't even, what did I do? Where was I? Who was I? I can't even think about what happened 2 days ago.
We had a really low-key weekend too, which was nice because I feel like I'm traveling a little bit more for speaking and you'll be traveling next week. So I know you're kind of busy too. And so it's nice to have a low-key weekend. And it was also March Madness in our house. I don't know if we have any March Madness discos, but my husband is a March Madness fanatic. So he is thriving right now with basketball on the TV.
I keep meaning to like check the scores and the brackets because
sure you do.
No, U of A is usually pretty good at basketball. Like whenever I was in college, we made it to like the Final Four and like that was like our claim to fame. And I just can't, I don't know. It just keeps like, I'll remember right now. And as soon as we get off this podcast, I will not remember to go check the bracket.
It always blows me away about how non-sports of a house your house is.
Yeah, we're just not. I mean, Supercross is always on our TV on the weekends, but by on Supercross, not a lot of sports happening.
Yeah. Yep. Sorry. Very opposite of our house. Opposite of how I grew up too. So it's just, I'm
very foreign. Yeah. People that are sports household, it's super foreign how like anti-sports my family is, Dan's family is. Like we just are not into it. So I don't know. I'm sorry. Jeez, I'm feeling the hate today coming at me about my cold weather and my anti-sports. Actually, tease this upgrade for today's articles, though, because we are Supercross adjacent today with one article. And then we're talking all about the states and all of our like quirky food things. So let's just get into it.
Let's get into it. You're right. It did tee us up well. Okay. Diving into the first article to discover this week, headline, Raise Your Glass to Pink, the pop star who rocks California's organic wine scene. So this was out of Outside Magazine, and I loved it. I mean, I am not a huge Pink fan. I'll say that right away, but I don't know, this was so interesting. It was well written. And for whatever reason, for me personally, I feel like it's very captivating to learn about celebrities' ties and interest to food and farming.
Absolutely. It's like you get to get like peel back the layers of celebrities and get to know them a little better. And it's always so cool when they take like an interest in farming, which we'll get into that more for Pink. But for anyone who is not familiar with Pink, that is her stage name. Her real name is Alicia Moore, which I had no idea. Would have just called her Pink this whole article if they had not talked about that in the article, what her name was. But she,
you're like, that's an interesting name for the birth certificate. Pink, exclamation point.
Like, there's a really interesting story how she got that name, but this is like a PG rated podcast, so we will not get into how she got her name, but you guys are welcome to Google that if you'd like. But she's a platinum selling musician. She's been singing for literally like decades. She has 3 Grammys, a Daytime Emmy Awards, 4 Billboard Music Awards, 7 MTV VMAs, 2 MTV EMAs, I don't even know what those are, 2 Brit Awards, and a star on Hollywood Boulevard. So she's pretty dang famous.
Yeah, the girls know, you know, she knows what she's doing when it comes to the musical scene.
I know, I actually wanted to try this wine and I like put it on my grocery store list. And then as I started reading the article, I realized there is no chance of me trying this unless you go to a restaurant that serves it, because they have a multi-year long wait list. Like, people, this wine is a hot commodity.
Yeah, she, at the end of the article, they did list the restaurants she in. She's in very small, handful, few, but one of them was a resort in Montana. It's called the Paws Up Resort. It's actually not far from like my family ranch. And I was like, oh, we would definitely have access. We could jaunt over there and give her wine a big old swirl and swig.
I also thought it was really cute that the wine she had picked, some of them were rosé. So obviously like pink wines, like I just was like very on brand.
Oh, but did you read that she intentionally chose like a rosé that isn't pink in color? Because she said she didn't want to do, quote unquote, a pink wine.
Yeah, she was like very intentional about that. But this is, so it's a little bit more peach colored is what I read. But still, I'm like, come on, girl. It's a rosé. Like, I lean into the pink.
Well, no, I liked it because I think it highlighted to me that she was taking it seriously. Like, she could have been a, you know, celebrity that rolled out this like cheeky kind of wine that played off her name and was kind of like gimmicky. But I feel like she really truly, and which we'll get into, like loves being a sommelier. Like, she loves the farming process of it too, which I want to get into. And so I feel like the fact that she was like, I don't want to do this like pink wine, really spoke volumes to me.
Yeah, she's definitely gone into the like country living. I mean, her vineyard is outside of Santa Barbara, so I say like country kind of in like quotation marks, but they said for the interview she like pulled up from her home garden on like a UTV. Her 2 kids were riding along. You know, her husband, for people who don't know, is Carrie Hart. He is actually a professional motocross racer. Like, shout out to our, you know, dirt bike riders. I love that about her. But yeah, she's definitely embraced like the farming side, country living side of being like a vineyard, at a vineyard, living on a vineyard, like leaving LA. They've lived there for 10 years now. Like, she is committed to this craft.
Yeah. And at first I didn't, I was like kind of shocked when we, so Disco actually sent us this article. Thank you. And I was like, oh, Pink is a farmer. Like, it kind of caught me off guard a little bit, but then the more I like percolated on it and it like settled in, I was like, this makes sense. And I think it makes sense as a whole, right? We have talked about celebrities and farming before. We've covered, you know, we did a fun bit on just like a ton of different celebrities that are interested in farming. We also focused on like Ian Somerhalder and his wife, Nikki Reed, and how they were involved in the Common Ground film. So like, this isn't new like conversation, right? New rhetoric, like celebrities and farming. And the more we dive into it, the more I think about it, I'm like, it makes sense. Like, that juxtaposition of the rat race life. And I'm sorry, but the more I learn about Hollywood, the more I'm like, I think the interwebs of Hollywood is crazy. And so I could see people like Pink, people who are, I mean, she grew up in a rural community, I think, have this longing to kind of offset their crazy wild lifestyle with something simpler. And I think especially if you have kids, which I think was big for Pink.
Yeah, I love how she compared actually music to wine a lot.
I loved that too. I thought it was so cool to see how she related to both of them.
Yeah, this one was, they say it takes a lifetime to make your first album, but 6 months to make your second. but it takes a lifetime, I think, to even understand how to make your first bottle. So it just like, I, again, like we said this, but I just like give her such kudos for like taking it very seriously. I mean, she does have a team behind her and she like thanked them and shouted them out, but she tries to be very hands-on. I mean, it is not a necessarily like a small vineyard. Average size in California is 82 acres and hers is 25 acres and she's making about 36,000 bottles of wine.
Yeah. So two things. I also thought it was really cool that she acknowledged and mentioned her team. I mean, she referenced her mentors a lot. And I just thought it was cool that she acknowledged or didn't try to like pose that she was the expert. I feel like she really alluded to, I actually want to read from her website in a second, but she talks about her journey, about how she started taking classes. And I just felt like she brought you along for like truly the beginning stages of how she started. And she didn't like sugarcoat it. I thought she was very transparent about like, I made crappy wine in my closet. We started out in the garage. You know, like she didn't just kind of position herself as like peak the expert winemaker, buy my fancy wine.
Yeah, I think it was the 2014 vintage is her one that literally was made like in her kitchen, like or you said, like her closet. Like it was not professionally done. This was her experimenting with making bottles of wine.
The other thing before we dive into her origin story and the website that I kind of want to talk about, going back to what you just said about her team, she has a 4-person all women winemaking team. And I thought that is so pink to do kind of like a women empowerment. And I learned something really cool from you. Actually, we were just on a call a couple of days ago and you talked about how the dairy industry a lot of times has like female teams because of like kind of the intimacy of the job around like newborn and birthing. And I don't know, I hadn't learned any of that before.
There's actually some really cool movements in the winemaking industry to have females. Like I learned this from Enchantment, like one of our sponsors. Like they're obviously two sisters that own that winery and they brought in a expert winemaker from Napa and she will only work with women owned wineries. And that's why like Enchantment got selected to work with her. And so they are trying to like make more women involved. I actually have a cousin who got her degree in like winemaking. I know there's like a technical term for it. I don't remember the name. But I don't know. It's kind of cool to see like, again, a male dominated industry, but like who's drinking wine? Like a lot of times it's a more of like a womanly beverage, which I know is a stereotype, but it's kind of cool to see like women taking this thing that is like the end product is consumed by women, but like bringing it back to like the very grassroots of like growing it, the grapes and like harvesting and processing the grapes and all of that.
I mean, cue the Barbie sound music theme right now. Play our women anthem of 2020. Would that be 23 or 24? Yeah, 2023. Yeah, it came out then. Yeah. I think it's so cool to see women starting to represent the agriculture industry.
Okay, tell us about our origin story because then I have some more things about wine.
Yes, I was going to say, I want to kind of get into some details of her vineyard and wine before we close it out. So her origin story is really cool. I'm going to read from her website. Settle in because it is a titch longer, but I just think it's really beautiful. And I think, as we've said, it kind of peels back this connection between pink and wine and music and just her and her whole story. So she starts out saying, I've always been a dreamer, a believer, and a seeker. And this is one of my beliefs is that anything is possible. In my travels throughout my 20s and 30s, I learned that a great bottle of wine can be found anywhere at any price, that sharing it with a stranger can turn them quickly to a friend, and that this can be the catalyst to some of the best memories you will ever have to look back on. That's when, even though I didn't know it, Two Wolves was born. And I started to daydream. I started online courses at WSET and UCLA. I would jump off stage sweating and shaking from adrenaline and hurry to my computer to take my tests. I made pilgrimages to wine regions all over the world. I would study a single varietal on each trip. And finally, after years and years of fantasizing and making terrible carboys of wine in my closet, we took our baby girl and we left the city and plunked ourselves down on an organic vineyard in Santa Barbara County. I immediately signed us up for classes at Allen Hancock College, and we started making wine in the garage. But surprisingly, it was the farming that I most look forward to. Pruning is one of my favorite things to do in the world, and the best way to listen to a new album from start to finish. It was the hardest labor I had ever done outside of a concert, and I was hooked.
Oh, I love that.
I know. I think it's so beautiful. I love the idea of her having this, like everything at her fingertips, you know, like on the stage, a captivated audience, like, and Peak isn't like, you know, singing slow ballads on stage. She's doing like crazy shit on stage, right? So this image of her just like living that high lifestyle and then kind of craving and being drawn to immediately run back to like her sanctuary. I don't know. I think I like relate to that. Not that I'm like pink on stage, but every time like I'm in the big city, you know, like when we're in that hustle and bustle, it's like we feel that pull back to like our ranches, our farms.
Fun fact, I have like 1 degree of separation from pink.
You have 1 degree of separation from everyone, Tara. At this point, I know. Who doesn't Tara know?
This is such a good story, though. I think in like sixth grade, and I went to live in LA for a couple weeks to dance at the Edge dance studio. And one of the other young kids that was dancing there, I don't know if anyone remembers the music video where Pink had like a little girl who danced. That little girl was taking classes with us at the Edge, getting ready for her musical debut with
Pink. It could have been you, Tara. You could have.
I literally thought the same thing. Her. I was like, that should have been me.
Yep. You could have had her break her ankles and then you could have stepped in as the backup.
If only I had done that. Better luck next time, you guys. I'll try harder.
Okay, so getting into the details of her wine, it is called Two Wolves. We've kind of like mentioned that a couple times now. But have you heard the tale or folklore? I can never say that word. It's a hard word. But the folklore that Two Wolves is from. Have you ever heard that before?
I read a little bit about it, but I feel like you seem especially excited about this. So take it away.
Well, it's one of my favorites. I actually have it hanging in Tad's room. And it's,
oh, how funny.
Yeah. It's an old Cherokee one, and it's about like a grandfather and a grandson. And the grandfather tells the grandson that basically everyone has two wolves inside of them. One is good and one is bad. And we're at a constant battle between them all the time. And then the grandson says, well, how do you know which one wins? And the grandfather says, whichever one you feed.
That's a good quote for a kid's room like encouraging them to like,
especially a wild boy.
I don't know if the girls will relate to that.
Feed the good side. Feed the good wolf.
Okay. What I dove deep into was actually getting back to like my restaurant roots. So I grew up with my parents owning a restaurant group in a restaurant. And I feel like one of the things that always stresses people out about wine is when you order the bottle of wine and they present it to you at the table and people not knowing like all the etiquette. Mm-hmm. I was going to go through a couple of those things because I think there's some really interesting pieces to that.
There was the funniest reel I saw going viral where it's a guy and he's like swirling the wine. And then the caption says like me pretending to know what I'm doing, taste testing like the $12 bottle of wine on the menu. Exactly. That is so me.
I feel like that is like, and everyone's like, I don't actually know. And I really like am very like degaff about all this stuff, but I feel like some people like to be in the know. So the first thing, the bottle is presented to you. You make sure that it's the correct bottle you ordered. This is probably more important if you're ordering like a vintage or something, that it's the correct year and that it's exactly what you expected. The second, the server is going to open it and set the cork on the table. You can inspect the cork. I actually think this is kind of important. I like to inspect the cork to make sure it's not like soggy or that it's not like dry and crumbly. Some people...
I'm taking notes about the cork. That's a good one.
It is a good one, but the one that this is like where it gets a little fishy. Some people believe in smelling the cork or like sniffing it. And then other people say that's like a big faux pas, like do not sniff it. I will say what I think is if you actually know about wine and you sniff it and you know what you're smelling for, go ahead. If you don't know what you're smelling for, just
put the cork down. Leave the cork down. Leave it sitting.
Don't smell it. You're not going to look cool smelling it.
Yeah, no one looks cool smelling a cork bottle.
And then I feel like the part that is next is like exactly what you're talking about. Like people making a big deal of like swirling the wine. Again, I'm doing hand movements and people can't see me like looking at it. But really like give it, you know, a little swirl, a little taste. Like you don't have to be overly dramatic with it. But like I guess as get as into it as you want. And then I think the most important thing is say something really positive about the wine. Like get everyone at the table excited to try it because like you know, you were the host. You got presented with the wine like... Get everyone a little, you know, riled up and excited to try the wine. And then obviously the server will go around and pour everyone else's glass and you get poured last. So that's the way it goes. Oh, and then cheers. Look everyone in the eye and do not take another sip of wine until everyone has cheersed.
Oh, really? That's a rule?
I mean, I don't know that any of these are rules, but like.
But that's like an etiquette. Thing to do.
Yeah, everyone gets their glass of wine and they're all allowed to taste it before the cheers. You are not supposed to taste it until after the cheers. So now you know.
Interesting. Producer Maddie said something about is it tied to like bad luck?
I don't know.
Tara, you're leading this etiquette class.
Okay, then yes, it's tied to bad luck. I'm just making it up now as I go along. Okay. The last thing I will say is we are headed to wine country in just a couple months. So people are going to be able to follow along on Discover Ag.
Santa
we are
Barbara.
To Napa. No, we're headed to Napa.
Oh.
Natalie obviously did not book this trip.
Napa.
But we are going to be taking you guys to a winery that invited us to come and check them out. So we are so excited. When you crawl into bed at the end of a long day, there is nothing better than getting into soft, luxurious sheets. That's why Natalie and I are sleeping on Cozy Earth sheets.
Cozy Earth crafts luxury goods that transform your lifestyle. They have been featured on Oprah's Favorite Things 5 years in a row. They are worth the cost. Cozy Earth sheets have been in our sheet rotation for almost a month now, and Luke and I are so impressed. The first time I changed them after I put them on, Luke actually commented asking when I could put the old sheets back on again.
Beyond just sheets and bedding, Cozy Earth also has loungewear that comes in a variety of different styles and colors. And you guys, I am living in these loungewear sets. I have actually been a fan of their pajamas for years now. I got my first pair when Annalise was little, and they still look and feel amazing.
All Cozy Earth products come with a 10-year warranty, and Cozy Earth was kind enough to provide an exclusive offer for you guys, our discos. If you go to www.cozyearth.com and use code DISCOVER, you can get up to 35% off their site.
So one more time, that's www.cozyearth.com and use code DISCOVER to get 35% off site-wide.
All right, you guys, diving into the second article to discover this week, headline, the most popular snack in the U.S. is not what you'd expect. Let's be real. We almost always need a little nibble to tide us over before lunch, and nothing will pull us out of that 3:30 slump like indulging in a little treat. And while everybody has their own unique snack preferences, market research company HubScore recently released a map that reveals the most searched for snack in every single U.S. state. And the article that we covered out of Delish broke down that study.
This blew my mind. I don't know what I was expecting.
I don't believe this study. Hogwash.
I know.
It's made
up. That's how I feel. A number one snack in 18 different states was Rice Krispie treats. And don't get me wrong, I love a good Rice Krispie treat. I just am not like busting open a Rice Krispie treat at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Like, that's not the snack I'm going for.
Agreed. I guess in my mind, Rice Krispies to me are not a snack, they're a dessert. So to see them be the number one snack is kind of what threw me.
18 states.
18.
Like, I'm just like, how many people are lying? Or how many people did you interview? Because I just like am having a hard time picturing this.
Behind Rice Krispie, the leading 18 came second place, which was 16 states, Doritos. And the other front runner was Cheetos in 8 states.
Yeah, but it was kind of wild how it was separated. Doritos is more southeast and then Cheetos was more southwest. And actually, Nebraska and New Mexico, we were both Cheetos.
Yeah, so I thought that was so bizarre because I have obviously thought of like cultural and like heritage food being tied to regions. But Cheetos being regionally like popular, that just I couldn't wrap my head around why that would like be a regional thing, like why any of these would be a regional thing.
Some outlier states, though, one state picked Chex Mix, also confusing to me. I just if I am like needing something salty in the afternoon, Chex Mix is not going to do it for me at all.
Yeah, the other outliers were Lay's potato chips, Cheerios, which
Cheerios.
Can we talk about Cheerios? The article is funny because they're like, it was New Jersey. And they're like, is it an entire state populated by teething babies? Like what? Trail mix. But yeah, the whole thing, it felt like they only had 4 options. Like that's what I was envisioning in my mind. Like you have to pick between A, B, C, D, and E. Because I was like,
oh, maybe.
My afternoon snack is like carrots and ranch or a cheese stick and, you know, a beef stick. I'm like, none of these are anything I go to when it comes to snacking. I could not relate at all to any of it.
I did not relate to these either. I guess opening a bag of chips. Like somebody said Lay's, one of the states said Lay's, and not that I would pick Lay's, but I was like, okay, I could kind of see, like, I've done like cheese and crackers as an afternoon mm-hmm. snack and with like maybe some apples or something. I agree though, like a string cheese and a beef stick is my go-to in the afternoon when I'm hungry, with followed by like an Oreo. Also, Oreo, I like expected that to be high on the list.
I mean, literally anything else.
We're not doing those anymore?
Anything literally else that was anything on, the, else. On the list could have been on the list.
So this was actually kind of fun. We actually took it over to Discover Ag and asked people to tell us where they were from based on a food. And I'm not going to lie, so many of the foods, I was like, I don't even know what that is, let alone where it's from.
Okay. So yes, I want to dive into one I saw multiple times that I was like, I had no idea. It was so fun to learn about. But yeah, I could have browsed the comment section of that reel for hours. It was so fun to read where people were putting food, and then people would comment that were also from that state and recognize the food. And it was just fun to see like connections being made. There was even actually a direct-to-consumer made a connection with a future customer. It was so fun. Like someone inquired, like, oh, can people visit your farm? And she's like, yes, we're open, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, this is so cool. Like it was such a cool comment section to dive into.
So on that, I actually wanted to go and buy, like, I have it marked in my email, actually, that somebody said blueberry barbecue sauce, and they tagged a company that sells it. And I am like, I'm getting that for Dan. It sounds so freaking good. Again, I don't know what state that's from, but I was like, blueberry barbecue sauce? That sounds like weirdly good.
I wrote that down, too. I think it sounds delectable. Like, I am dying to try it. That would be so good this summer. So the first one that stood out to me that I had seen multiple times and I had never, never heard the word was Chislic.
Now, what is that?
Yep. So it is a culinary curiosity that has been woven into the fabric of South Dakota's story since before it became a state in 1889. Chislic is a dish consisting of skewered cubes of red meat, usually mutton or lamb, although game meat such as venison and even beefsteak can also be used. So it's kind of like kebabs, I guess.
Oh, that sounds yummy. Mm-hmm. I could get behind that.
I know.
Definitely.
But I just, Chislic. Never heard of it.
There was lots of the basics like cheese curds from Wisconsin, Georgia peaches, Florida oranges. I actually saw Sonoran dogs from Arizona, which I feel like is very niche, but I absolutely got it. If you've had a Sonoran dog in Arizona, like you'll never forget it ever in your life. And then I noticed that some were more like region specific. Like in California, I saw someone post about sourdough and I think it was clam chowder, and they were obviously from San Francisco. And then someone else did like Baja fish tacos and they were from Southern California. So I was like, I feel like big states like California might need to like divide up into different categories.
Mm, yeah. Okay. That's a good point. Did you see Gator Tail and Gatorade?
No, I did not see those ones.
So, well, it was the same person wrote both of them, Gator Tail and Gatorade. So I was like, oh, that must to be Florida for the Gator Tail, I was thinking. And then I was like, oh, is Gatorade must be like invented there or something. So I Googled a quick search of Gatorade's history, and it was. It was invented at the UF College of Medicine by a team of researchers led by Dr. Robert Cade. So it was first tested in a football scrimmage near the site and was first used in an October 1965 Gator victory.
I had no idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw actually in grocery store that Gatorade is like rebranding as water. I thought that was like an interesting twist on this.
They listen, they're discos. They listen to our last episode on Liquid Death and they're like, okay, this is where the money is. Team, we're rebranding. Quick, huddle up, like figure out how to make this happen.
That was another thing I saw a ton of was crawfish. And I was like, oh my gosh, all our Louisiana discos. I was like, I hope everyone thought we did good covering crawfish a couple weeks ago, because there was a ton of comments about crawfish. There was other basics like potatoes, Idaho. I loved the salmon and moose from Alaska. And then there was a couple that kind of threw me, like maple syrup. I saw you actually comment and you were like Vermont and they were like, no, Canada.
They're like, no, you dummy.
And I was like, okay, there is some. Yeah, they were like, geez, Natalie, come on. But there was a few foods that I was like, I feel like that could be more than one play.
For sure.
Like apples, cherries. I was like, is it Washington? Like, or there's more than one food for some places.
So speaking of Canada, I saw baked milk and I was like, yes, I know this. It's Canada, isn't it?
No, we have that in the United States too. I grew up with bagged milk in my elementary school. I mean, I think maybe Canada like does it more, but I absolutely had bagged milk in my cafeteria.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's like in the grocery stores in Canada. Like that is how Canada gets their milk, is bagged milk.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Okay, we need discos. We need Canadian discos to weigh in on this stat because I'm pretty
that
sure it is like
really risky. Like I feel like that bag is getting pierced in my fridge and I'm ending up with milk everywhere.
My youngest child, Rue, drinks milk all the time. I could see him literally like popping it and just like standing in the kitchen and just like pouring. Like, yeah, I could just vision him like bathing, like taking a shower in milk. It would be such trouble. The last one I'll call out was one that I feel like made me giggle like a little teenage boy, but they wrote ham balls. I don't know why.
I saw that one. I wanted to ask what it was, but I just couldn't work up the nerve.
Ham balls.
I also saw a disco that was like, Coors, can we do beer? Uh-huh. And I was like, sure, we can do beer. That's good. Hershey Bar was Pennsylvania. And then my last one for you is, what is Runza?
Yes, Runza? Yes. Runza did.
Tell me more.
Yes. So Runza is actually, it's actually a fast food chain in Nebraska as well. So literally you could go to like a, you know, it's like McDonald's, Subway. It's like called Runza. They're kind of like a, I guess maybe like a European meat stuff pastry. And so, yeah, they're very popular in the Midwest. I had never heard of them before I had moved to Nebraska. And it's definitely a very, very popular thing here, a Runza.
Okay, well, New Mexico is easy. Lots of green chili people, actually a couple red chili people, but still from New Mexico in the comments. And then the last thing that I want to talk about is actually kind of adjacent to this. There is this really cool test online that you can take, like a quiz. And based on how you say things, like different foods and different words, it will tell you where you're from. And it was so cool. I remember actually one of the words that it asked you was what do you call crawfish? Like, do you call them crawdaddies? What was it? Mud fish, whatever, like all the different words we said, but it had tons of different words. Like, do you say pajamas? And it was insanely accurate. And so I like want the discos to go and like find this quiz and take it, because mine said I was from Amarillo, Texas, which is literally 90 miles away. It was accurate for my mom, my grandma, Daniel. The only person in my family it wasn't accurate for was my dad. It said he was from Alaska, which just like has me rolling. But it just like reading through everyone's things, like there's just such specific things that people call things, name things, like food choices. Like even when I'm talking with you, like the other day we were recording a Discover Ag and you said catty corner and I say kitty corner. And that's one of the regional differences of like things people say. And I just like, I feel like that's just so fascinating of like how different we all talk.
One thing that I think about all the time, it's like a mini Roman Empire for me, is how you don't realize you have an accent, but to other people, you have an accent. You know, like when we were actually at South by Southwest, we were talking with a guy that was actually from France. I think it was France, wasn't it? Was he French?
He was from Italy.
Italy. Oh, okay. Italy. And I made a comment about his accent. He's like, my accent, your accent. And I was like, my accent? Like, I don't have an accent, you know? And like, I think about that all the time, about how your region, you sound so normal. But then when you travel anywhere else, they're like, it's just, I don't know. I think about it all the time.
Totally. As we are all becoming more conscientious of what we are putting in our bodies, we should also be looking at what we are putting on our bodies and our faces. Rolling up to my mid-30s this year, I realized I wanted to step up my skincare routine. But as I was looking for products, I wanted ingredients I believed in, like beef tallow. Enter Tubes & Co. Tubes & Co.'s entire skincare and makeup line is 100% natural and uses only organic ingredients like grass-fed tallow, aloe vera, cold-pressed olive oil, and they are committed to never using synthetic chemicals, GMOs, toxins, fillers, artificial colors, or fragrances. Tubes & Co. is a husband and wife team that believes it's not good enough for you until it's good enough for their own family. They go above and beyond to source organic products made in the United States and support small family-owned farms. I personally love a wide range of their products, from their skincare line. I love the basic beef tallow balm to the hydrating stick. And for their makeup, I love the blush and so much more. I know that Natalie uses their body wash, toner, mascara, and tons of other products. If you want to try Tubes & Co. for yourself, go to tubesandco.com, use our code DISCOVER to save yourself some money, or click the link in our show notes and use code DISCOVER.
All right, before we get into our last article, we do want to do a disco highlight. This one came from Jor Johnson, titled Refreshing and Intellectual. The unbiased conversations these two have are so refreshing. Being able to look at a topic and see the perspective from both sides takes intelligence and humility. I love how that information is delivered through thought-producing topics that I can bring into future conversations about food and ag. Thank you so much, George Johnson. If you are listening and that is you, please DM us on the Discover Ag Instagram page so we can send you some Discover stickers. And if that is not you and you want stickers of your own, take a second to rate and review us after you listen. It means so much to us as these reviews help us grow and get new people discovering. All right, diving into our last and final article to Discover, headline, Cow Hacked with Human DNA Produces Milk Containing High Levels of Human Insulin. Milk to the rescue? Question mark. A team of scientists from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the Universidad de Sao Paulo, Brazil. Sorry, guys. Have made history as they have discovered a gene-edited cow that produces human insulin in its milk. This discovery could herald a new era in insulin production, potentially eliminating drug scarcity and high costs for people living with diabetes.
I feel like you're going to have a lot to say about this one. Our in-house pharmacist.
That's so hilarious because I was thinking, I bet you would, being dairy. And I was also thinking how this is the perfect meld of common interest between us, like dairy and pharmacy. Who would have thought? Yeah. Who would have thought? I will say this is wild to me. It's actually absolutely like crazy knowing, again, coming from a little bit of like a pharmaceutical background, which we can get into the details, but they were talking like the units of insulin that this could possibly produce. And it was just, this could be really, really big for the medical industry.
Yeah. So I think at face value, I am so excited about this. I think this could be incredible. I think this is such an amazing like use of research and like gene editing and all these things. But it also makes me nervous. I don't know if you remember a couple weeks ago, there was the entire like vaccine in lettuce like thing going viral where some representative said there was going to be like vaccines in lettuce, which if you dived at all deeper, like that was not the case. I'm worried about this. Like, oh my gosh, they're putting medicine in milk now. Like I can just see the headlines forming already. And so while I'm really excited, I think we have to be super careful about like the PR and like the messaging and like actually people understanding what's happening. Like this would be a certain herd of dairy cows used for nothing but creating insulin for cows. And so I think that's, I don't know, that was like my initial thoughts going into this article.
Yeah, so that was actually like my big takeaway conclusion from this is like, what will the general public think about this? I did write down that in my opinion, when it comes to technology and advancements like this, I feel like the general public is a little bit more open to medicine, like animals being involved with medicine than they are with animals being involved with food, I guess, or like medicine being involved with food a little bit. And so, you know, for me, I saw a divergent between kind of as you were talking about, like the milk and the insulin, or they're, you know, they're putting drugs in our milk. Whereas hopefully if the public gets it, it's a little bit more of like this drug is coming from an animal. And that's actually, and I'm not going to say common, but like we have, you know, pig heart valves and like Lovenox is a very common medicine. And that's like, you know, animal, we get it from animals. Thyroid, there's certain thyroid medicines. And so like dating back for a long time, we have used animals to help us produce medicine. So I will be very curious if this is done the right, like if this goes through, which we'll get into, they still have like a lot of things that need to happen for this to even become a reality. If it ever got to that place, I think this could either be rolled out the right way and you would see this, you know, make a difference to our medical industry, or I think this would be positioned, marketed and talked about the wrong way and it would flop and it would not make, you know, a difference to our medical industry.
I agree. Okay, so a little bit of background, like what did they actually do? In Brazil, they inserted a segment of human DNA coded for pro-insulin. So basically like a protein that is the precursor of active form insulin. They put it into 10 cow embryos. They were implanted in the uterus of normal cows in Brazil, and one transgenic calf was born. And a lot of this is like new technology of actual like targeted expressions for genes. And so obviously the goal was that the like mammary tissue would then produce milk that had, they were actually hoping that it would just have pro-insulin. And instead, they actually ended up with already created insulin, which is just insane. Like hearing the researchers talk about this, how freaking amazing the mammary gland is and like the tissue and like what it can do and how it can create protein was just fascinating.
Yeah, that was actually the quote from one of the lead scientists who headed this. He said, the mammary gland is a magical thing. And I was like, well, isn't that a soundbite to put out there? The mammary gland is a magical thing. But I was like, this is like Harry Potter level. I mean, you talked about how they said they were shocked at what the cow did. Like they did not even think it was possible for her to do what happened. And so they were like kind of taken aback by this science and this experiment.
Yeah. And one of the cool things is the way that they did it, it didn't even end up where the cow had any like human insulin circulating in her body. It was strictly contained to just like the milk production, which again is like a really big feat that, you know, this is like very cutting edge technology. But I will say cutting edge technology because this is only a proof of concept phase. There are still like probably a ton more phases this has to go through before it can actually get any kind of approval.
Yeah, definitely more testing is needed. They actually talked about how they like the next step is to try and repeat this. The team plans to reclone the cow and then is optimistic that they'll achieve hopefully greater success. It had something to do with like the full lactation cycles, which I didn't exactly get. You probably got being
a dairy. I can go into that when you finish.
Being a dairy farmer. But basically they talked about that. And then they also talked about how they could even see into the future, like trying to create a bull to mate with the males and females. And then through that, you know, they'd be able to establish almost like this purpose-built herd. Again, it seems so, I don't know. People could say scary. I mean, there's a lot of adjectives you could insert in this, depending on your viewpoint and your connection to food and how you view advancements of technology like this when it comes to, you know, the animal industry. But I really, going back to, I mean, type 1 diabetes is, you know, diabetes in general is a huge medical problem. I mean, I did not look up stats, but the amount of money we spend, you know, not just in the United States, but worldwide on, you know, diabetes. And to think that this, which we can get into after you, you know, go back to whatever else you want to talk about, being able to produce that amount of insulin, they talked about how it would basically just wipe out like our current methods for it.
Yeah, the cost can be as high as $1,300 per month for people out of pocket for insulin is what I saw at like the peak of heights. I know there's been changes in regulations and different things, but either way, it's super expensive.
Yeah, they said, so the cow produces like a gram per liter and each gram is equivalent to just under 30,000 units. And to put that in perspective, I mean, diabetes is such a, depending on the severity, everyone doses a different amount of units. But there are people who dose like, you know, 9 units, maybe like before they eat or whatever. Like thinking about, you know, how much, you know, 9 units compared to 30,000 units of insulin. And they said each cow can produce 50 liters a day. I mean, you were talking massive amounts of insulin, essentially.
Yeah, a cow every day could be producing, what would that be, like 150,000 units, like a ton of units. It's just crazy. But just the potential of like life-changing, like, you know, a drug that saves people's lives is incredible.
Yeah. And one thing they also talked about too is how eventually this would still need sign off from the FDA, like the Food and Drug Administration. So there's a lot they need to work out on, like the legalities of it, you know, the supply chain, how they purify the lentil, how they collect it, how they produce it, all of that. But there are also legalities they still need to go through when it comes to like actually getting it approved. And it makes me wonder too, like if there's other places besides the FDA that would need to sign off on it. I don't know. I feel like I always get really overwhelmed trying to understand like who signs off on what when it comes to like legatory and like government institutions and stuff. But this is obviously a very beginning stage. We keep saying that, but I feel like it's a very exciting beginning. To that note, though, thinking again about how much of a difference this could make, you know, here nationally and also worldwide when it comes to diabetes and just like the healthcare industry, I do like going back to what we first opened this up with about like public perception and acceptance of this. It like always makes me so frustrated a little bit that like something like this could get shot down just because, I don't know, we didn't explain it
public
properly
perception.
Or people's disconnect from like the understanding of it. Or like even thinking about like when you were talking about, well, because they couldn't rebreed the cow. I know that's like a trigger point for so many people, like breeding a milk cow. And it's just things like that where I'm like, how do we as an industry better market proposition and talk about ourselves and talk about these things so that we can have like make a big difference like this and improve like, I don't know, improve the world, like literally.
No, I mean, I talked about that in South by Southwest, that one of my favorite quotes is that people love innovation, but they hate change. And I think that's like, this is one of those key moments that people, you know, think that like innovation and technology is so cool and innovation in every aspect of their life is cool. But when it comes to like food or, you know, agriculture or like this, like something that's a meld between like medical research and agriculture, like they get really scared and nervous about it. And I think a lot of it is just like not understanding, like there is a lot of uncertainty in the unknown and like you feel more comfortable in the known. And so getting into this like unknown can feel really uncomfortable. So the final thing I'll say is actually looking to the future. There was a really great quote from one of the researchers, and it said, "I could see a future where a 100 head herd, so the equivalent to like a small dairy farm, could produce all the insulin needed for the country." And then he said, "And a larger herd, you could make the whole world supply for a year." So the possibilities are really endless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super exciting. And I know, kudos to this team. I always think about how brilliant the researchers are and the people that were involved in this kind of studies are. So kudos to the team, the two different universities for kind of heading this and finding this. I will close it out with saying two things, actually. One, if this kind of conversation interests you, back on our episode 138 on January 25th, we talked about gluten and different you know, future possibilities with gene editing wheat in order to make it tolerable for people with celiac disease and gluten intolerances, which was a really interesting, fascinating conversation.
Oh, good call. Good tie back. That is like really well connected to this. Like if you find this fascinating, that was also a fascinating article.
Yep. And then as always, we gave you guys a lot of calls of actions to head over to our Discover Instagram page and let us know your thoughts about different things, you know, in Article 1, Article 2, and Article 3. So we would love to carry out the conversation as we do every single week after this airs, talking about it, you know, from your guys' opinion and what you think about it. So head on over there and let us know about today's episode. And we will see you guys next week.
This has been a 58 Ember production. For more shows, please visit the 58 Ember channel, 58ember.com, or find us at 58 Ember Media on socials.